Hello, readers. Welcome to the MSI Press podcast. I am Marianne Ramish, a copy editor for MSI Press, and I am here today with one of our authors. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Hi, my name is Ren Yuandong, and I'm the author of Rainstorm of Tomorrow, The Ever-Flowing Banquet of Philosophy, a book on the philosophy of science. Thank you for having me here today.
Of course. Now, to start off, can you tell me about your background in philosophy, science, and spirituality? What do you do?
I am a healthcare consultant based in Tokyo, and I've been working in the pharmaceutical industry for almost 6 years. Before that, I studied both philosophy and economics in the university, learned three languages, and having traveled to over 30 countries.
Wow. So can you give us an example of how your background inspires your philosophical views in the book?
Sure. For example, my professional tenure in healthcare and biology has inspired and reshaped my perception of the essential structure of our universe. I was once asked to explain why carbapenem, a class of highly effective antibiotics usually reserved as the last means to treat infections, is effective to some MDR bacteria, which is the multi-drug resistant bacteria, or the superbacteria we usually call, whereas it is not so effective to other weaker ones that can even be managed by the co-administration of aspirin and etc. And I answer in the following. Imagine a chamois living in the rock mountains. The natural fortress almost shelters them from most natural disasters like fire, drought, and hurricanes. However, they are extremely vulnerable to the earthquake that may lead to a rockfall. Now, what about their distant relative, the antelope, living on the plain? They are prone to many disasters, again the fire, drought, and hurricanes, but need not to worry too much about the earthquake. After all, there aren't many falling objects to watch out on the plain. Therefore, the level of harm the earthquake can bring is not definite but relative to different species of different habitats. Ditto the strength of carbapenem can do to different microbes. Amazed by the distant similarities across the microscopic and the macroscopic phenomena, I proposed a bold conjecture of our universe later when I wrote this book. The universe is not composed of infinite time and space, but rather constitutes the inner body of a giant creature. The nebulas and stars within the universe correspond to the organs and soft tissue of this giant creature. If that is the case, then what are humans? The answer is that human beings are essentially the parasitic bacteria living within the giant creature. Despite a lack of means to either validate or falsify this conjecture, such a worldview may provide interesting insights to many other ontological and ethical questions. For example, are we probiotics or harmful bacteria in that case? Are natural disasters and environmental changes movements of a universe-generated immune response to human overcrowding and pollution? Moreover, what is taking place in vitro of this giant creature? Perhaps there is another, even larger organism in comparison with which our universe, the giant creature, may be as small as a parasitic bacterium. So the structure of the nature may thus circulate endlessly.
In the book, you talk about the fact that philosophy welcomes questions but evades answers. Can you explain the title of your book, Rainstorm of Tomorrow, and how it ties in with that observation? What is the rainstorm you're referencing?
So the title, Rainstorm of Tomorrow, The Ever-Flowing Banquet of Philosophy, is a refutation of Stephen Hawking's declaration that philosophy is dead. As philosophers have not kept up with the science, their art is dated. This work, however, casts light on philosophical questions that are ultimately beyond the reach of science by referencing to scientific contexts, the type of questions that can be addressed but not answered so long as we hold to our positions of human beings. That being said, philosophy remains one of the most frustrating disciplines in that it is not about answers but about living questions. And this never-perishing sense of frustration is symbolized by the everlasting rainstorm of tomorrow, which is actually not something to be rid of, but rather held as the ultimate driver of human civilization.
Many topics you cover in your book are usually discussed in a vacuum rather than appearing side by side in the pages of a book. Books will cover just spirituality, just philosophy, or just science. One thing I took away from your book is how, when analyzed together, you can see how all of these methods for making sense of the world do eventually overlap the further you dive into them.
Yeah, but I don't really look for the overlap purposefully. However, given the fact that, you know, each discipline is just a language capable of encompassing all phenomena in the world, just each speak with a unique voice, one could almost expect the theories from different subjects and the methodologies to converge. For example, biological reactions can be expanded to millions of chemical reactions or trillions of interactions between physical particles. Likewise, the emergence of social behaviors among neural networks as they grow and that of tacit agreement from quantum entanglement have implied the possibility of adopting a sociological language to explain phenomena previously deemed as lifeless and strictly adherent to the laws of physics. This deja vu becomes even so through learning. The essence of any learning process is to interpret a new theory with one's knowledge to facilitate and improve the comprehension. So before you realize it, you have already been seeking for rules and familiarity in the unknown area with your previous knowledge. And the more you learn, the more likely you will find the connections and contradictions between what is new and what you have already learned. With the advancement of disciplinary differentiation, however, individual pieces of knowledge nowadays are often restrained to the little patch of his or her own specialty. For one to grasp a holistic picture of the world, we need to weave the threads of different disciplines together, and I believe that tapestry is called the philosophy of science, and that's where my book comes to help.
And I think that we can use that kind of help. People across social media, for example, are constantly shouting at each other to say, you're wrong, I'm right. I think your book does a good job of finding the way to a state of peace through all the chaos. It offers a perspective that many things that may seem irreconcilable can actually be one, and the universe can hold them both. Can you unpack any examples of that for our listeners?
Sure. I would like to share an example of reconciling two conflicted social theories through biological explanation. There are two conflicted schools of thought trying to explain our social behaviors today. One is evolutionary psychology and the other is called social learning theory. Evolutionary psychology views the emergence of modern civilization as occupying only a fraction of the span of human history. Hence, it does not affect the evolutionary direction of human beings from ancient times. Therefore, cognition in the modern human brain is often slow to update and is similar to that of our ancestors, as if we have Stone Age minds in modern scales. Social learning theory, on the other side, asserts that man-made social environment has long since replaced the natural environment as the primary living environment for people. Human choice has thus taken the place of natural selection and become the dominant power in human evolution through the selection and improvement of genes. Which theory is correct then? Well, one possible answer might be both. Perhaps genetic selection improvement, as evolutionary psychology puts it, is an extremely long process and will not accelerate or mutate because of the short-lived human civilization. Cultural evolution may be able to optimize the gene expression of the existing ones through epigenetic modification. Based on the fact that different phenotypes can be derived from the same genotypes. Social learning theory also refers to the continued production of lactase after weaning among society with developed animal husbandry as an evidence of culture selection, and epigenetic modification may account for such a phenomenon. Now we know everyone possesses the genes or genome that control the production of lactase, since each individual is capable to produce it during infancy. In normal circumstances, epigenetic modification switch on the function of producing lactase while breastfeeding and switch it off after weaning. In societies with well-developed animal husbandry and a dairy-based diet, keeping the function switched on after weaning will undoubtedly reduce the burden of other digestive enzymes, thus greatly benefit the individual's digestive system. Since this temporary epigenetic modification of enzyme benefits the individual over the long run, it is later consolidated and retained across generations. Therefore, animal husbandry does not select high-quality lactase genes. In fact, there may not even be a single gene solely for lactase production. It simply extends the length of time the gene expression express the specific functions through epigenetic modification of the same relevant gene.
Okay. Now, another interesting concept you dove into was humans' perception of beauty and ugliness, good smells and bad smells, and how that is all evolutionary. Things like our instinctual fear of the dark as children and the sound of nails on a chalkboard. You also discuss human survival instincts and utilitarianism, our desperate sense that we need to survive for survival's sake. Can you unpack that idea a little bit for the listeners? What is utilitarianism and how is it good and also bad?
Okay, sure. It is acknowledged that although the acquired experience of each individual are different, we are surprisingly consistent with one another in some particular ideas or concepts, as if they are not derived from acquired experience or prenatal experience, but rather belongs to some kind of priori knowledge that one is born with. Taking aesthetic as an example, for humans uninfluenced by specific values, say babies, they tend to regard curves as more beautiful than straight lines, a colorful palette more appealing than monochrome ones, music more malicious than noise, and a prosperous life more pleasant than a wanting one. The reason why people favor colors over monochrome may be traced back to ancient memories, when our ancestors still lived in a primitive nature environment, where a colorful world represents daytime and the world cast in black and white meant that the night has fallen. As a diurnal creature whose vision is limited in a monochrome world and whose audition is relatively weak, humans would have faced a higher risk from predators by night. And across generations, the mentality of looking forward to the colorful days and fearing monochrome night would have become ingrained in humans. By the same means, we can explain the physiological aversion to the sound of fingernails scratching a blackboard, for example, because this sound just resembles the sound of beasts crushing the skulls of our primitive ancestors. Whenever our ancestor heard a sound at that pitch, they knew that one of their fellows had been hunted down by a nearby beast, and they could avoid the dangerous area and guarantee their survival by establishing a conditioned reflex to it. And so as we can see, many innate ideas of mankind across different races and cultures can be traced back to the distant memory of human ancestry, where humans regard things beneficial to human survival as true, virtuous, and attractive, and those harmful as false, evil, or hideous. Such judgment itself is in line with the principle of utilitarianism, of pursuing collective interests and avoiding harm. Successive generations of memory inheritance, however, have only retained the conclusions and forgotten the reasons. Well, despite the success of utilitarianism in sustaining human survival, we need not necessarily adhere to utilitarian purpose for everything we do in life, as in reality, we often find that behavior thirsting for quick success and instant rewards departs from the doctrines of utilitarianism, while other behavior that is seemingly absent of desires compares with teachings of utilitarianism in unexpected ways, which demonstrate both its dialects and the unity of opposites.
Okay, that was something really fascinating in your book that I couldn't help apply to the modern day. So bringing things out of the world of theory and into the reality we are living right now. COVID-19, of course, has changed the world we live in. For the rest of my life, I'm sure we will be talking about things in terms of pre and post COVID. I know for me, especially in the United States, it seems as though people are living in two different realities and our understanding of the world we live in is deeply divided. I know it's a touchy subject right now, but if you're willing to, I would be fascinated to hear your interpretation of the big divide that is happening with the discussion of COVID-19 in terms of utilitarianism and survival instincts.
Okay, sure. I'm not sure whether it's related to utilitarianism or not, but I'm just going to share my insights about this COVID-19. So to me, like the crisis stemmed from COVID-19 brings forth actually two challenges, one to our science and technology, and especially questions our pharmaceutical technologies, and the other to our moral standards. As for the first challenge, I think it's time to refresh our naive understanding of virus as being simply unintellectual and could just mutate. The varied and systematic syndromes caused by COVID-19, such as the pneumonia, Kawasaki disease in patriotic patients, loss of speech, taste, and smells, have all indicated a sign of wisdom. How successful the virus are in intruding human bodies and initiates different destruction mechanisms based on different external environments. The question then lies in, are we capable of designing a micro warrior that is equally intelligent and flexible to combat COVID-19 with evolutionary strategies according to the virus behavior? Now, I was drawn to this point by the success traditional herbal medicine shows in relieving mild and moderate patients, which is, well, to be honest, quite counterintuitive, as we have long believed modern medicine, which has further refined effective ingredients and removed impurities, should be more effective than its raw material. As the poem puts it, to see a world in a grain of sand and a heaven in a wild flower, it almost seems to me that we are not simply prescribing a herbal leaf to human bodies, but an exquisite micro-ecosystem where many mechanisms still remain unformidable and inimitable to human science. When science is absent, ignorance throws the party, and here comes our second challenge. There has always been heated debates on whether government should implement lockdown policies or should force the public to wear masks. It is noteworthy that the normal surgical masks we buy don't protect us from infections. Instead, it protects others from our sneeze and droplets. Therefore, mask wearing is an altruistic behavior and could only achieve a prophylaxis when the entire society does so. And when mask wearing becomes an obligation, some people just feel this infringes their freedom. We know everywhere there are people died from extreme sports, yet we don't condemn them for the reason that we respect their freedom and their values to prioritize experience over life. Mm-hmm. But this all has one big premise, that is, your freedom does not really endanger others' life, which is not the case that we face in the coronavirus pandemic. However, due to the deceitful nature of COVID-19, even when transmit virus to another person by not wearing masks, the latter may remain asymptomatic for a long time or just develop very mild symptoms. And by the time, like, finally one unlucky patient gets killed by the virus, it's almost impossible to trace back the source of infection. So without a clear documentation of the causal chain and an immediate consequence of breaking the rules, one could easily rid himself or herself of the guilty feelings and self-deceive that COVID-19 is nothing more than a flu. Thus, I say it's a challenge to our moral standard by asking us the question, are we willing to wear the mask, as not doing so may, not must, help the transmission of the disease? And to raise the hurdle even higher, are we still willing to wear the mask, as even doing so cannot 100% eradicate disease, since there are people not wearing masks and breaking the prophylaxis frontier?
That makes a lot of sense. If the cause and effect was more immediate, I do think discussions about wearing a mask or not would be a little less heated than they are. So that brings me to the end of my questions. Thank you so much for joining me today. And if listeners are interested in learning more about these subjects or following you on social media, where can people find you?
The book Rainstorm Tomorrow, The Ever-Flowing Banquet of Philosophy, is available for sale on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. In addition, there is a Facebook page and discussion group that frequently share news, excerpts, and thread of thought for a pre-read of the book. So welcome to join us. You can find both of them by searching book title Rainstorm Tomorrow in Facebook. The book is also listed on Goodreads, so don't forget to mark the book as true read, so you won't miss any potential giveaway opportunities in future. I look forward to your reviews and feedback once you have read my book, and I'm also happy to answer questions or participate in the discussion through that platform. In the time of coronavirus pandemic, let's stay safe, connected, and spiritually enriched.
Thank you so much. Stay safe.
Thank you so much.